Kirk, you're a historian. Who found the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Dead Sea Scrolls were a little Arabian boy, probably a Muslim, who happened to stumble across the caves of Qumran and said, "Oh, look at here."
Yeah. Do you think Yahweh used the little Muslim boy, or do you think the little Muslim boy was just off doing his thing and stumbled upon it? And goodness, there it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's the case, too. If Yahweh specifically was using someone to find it and was going to intervene in free will, and he can. I mean, you know, if Abraham and Moshe were both a little reluctant to begin with, particularly Moshe, I was not going to force them. You know, you have to be willing to do it. I don't think there's one chance in a jillion that Yahweh used that young Arab boy.
No, not at all.
And if he had chosen to use someone to find it, do you think he would have used somebody that would not have turned it over to the Roman Catholic Church and to Islamic control?
Not a chance. Took
another 30 years for us to even get a glimpse of what was inside of it?
No, not a chance. He would have protected it the way he always did.
Exactly.
In the Ark.
Right. So have we benefited from the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Absolutely,
being
we have.
Tremendously.
Yeah.
That does not mean that God used the Bedouin boy to find it. Similarly, I find the lexicons particularly useful in understanding what God said.
Yes.
And yet with the lexicons, I realized they were published by religious institutions. And for them to be of value to me, right, to be of value to me, I have to filter out religiosity. For example, I just translated two passages here in the last couple of days where they took Torah, and if you look up their definition, their first definition is law.
Law.
And they're just wrong. It's just that's not what it means. Not my opinion. God's very thorough in describing what it means, and he speaks of it in a way that definition only works if you're completely irrational.
Right.
So you have to use a filter. With Ron Wyatt, you have to use a filter because, yes, he would talk about Jesus and Christ and cite the New Testament as if it were Scripture. And so you have to use a filter with him. But it doesn't change the merit of what he found. And for Ron, I don't know if it was he was trying to prove the Torah's accuracy, or if it was that he had a genuine curiosity and believed that what God had said is true and wanted to find these things just for the curiosity of them. But you said something during the break, which is very true, and we're going to go to the next thing that he found, and it's really important to view it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't read Ron Wyatt trying to prove that what we had come to know about Yahweh was true.
Mm-hmm.
Had no influence on me whatsoever in that regard. But it's each of the things that he found, because of where they are and the nature of the, whether it be the topography or the general geographic location or some of the elements like the metallurgy of the bolts, they were a glue lamb construction, if you will. That the dimensions were consistent in length, greater in width because the boat had been splayed. Although when he measured the beams themselves, the beams then measured exactly the Torah's dimensions. All of those things provide for those who are looking at them from the right perspective, just another way of putting all the pieces together.
Mm-hmm.
And you can build on those pieces. And I think that when we try to understand Yah's words in a vacuum, they're much more difficult than they are when viewed from the perspective of the world and the universe as we know it. A great example. We talk about Einstein and his discovery two of them, really, that time is relative based upon the perspective of the viewer, and that time moves more slowly in the presence of great energy or velocity or mass, and that that energy, light, therefore, and matter are exactly the same thing, just not the same amounts of the same thing. And when you then compare that to what Yahweh said about eternal life, about his nature and light, about the set-apart spirit and the most set-apart Yahusha, when you read what Yahweh said and then can augment it with those scientific discoveries of a man who is probably an agnostic, your overall understanding is greatly enhanced. In other words, the Torah is not designed to view another world. It's designed to provide a perspective of this one.
Yeah.
And so
that's not afraid of knowledge.
No. And so that's an example. And the finding the Ark of the Covenant, I view exactly the same way. Now, he was, Ron was convinced, as am I, that Constantine Mommy got everything wrong, and that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is in the wrong place. That Golgotha means Golgotha, which means Golgotha, which only means Golgotha, the place of the skull.
Right.
There's a place of the skull. I have been there, man. I get goosebumps just looking at it. And if you want to see it, there's hundreds of pictures online that you can look at and see it. And that's exactly how it looks, particularly from the back parking lot of the Jerusalem bus station that is set right there. And guess what? What's at the top of the of that embankment where the skull is still visible in the cliff walls? What's at the top?
Isn't that the hose for the... Or is that, no, that's in the front, isn't it?
No, the top. What's, you know, if you're standing in the Jerusalem bus station, which is 700 strides from the Damascus Gate and the Temple Mount.
Oh, well, that's the hose where they would have put the upright pole.
Well, yeah, you'll find that. Ron White found that, the receptacle in the limestone where the upright pole was placed. At the top of that embankment is the summit of Mount Moriah.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah. Sorry.
Summit of Mount Moriah, and it's completely uninhabited. The most coveted city in the world, most spectacular view, most important location and best view, and the most coveted place on earth. And there ain't nothing there. As it was when Yahweh and Abraham went there. And so it's obvious where the outside of the Damascus Gate, where the place of the crucifixion took place, the fulfillment of Pesach. And if you look up there, there's the summit of Mount Moriah, and into that, the hill on the summit, kind of on the south side of it, is where the empty tomb is.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly where you expect all this stuff to be. And so, Ron, I think, you know, I've read, it's no longer published because the curator of his museum doesn't like this story anymore. They don't want it to be known. They've done everything to quiet Ron's findings in this regard. But I encountered Ron's widow before they had taken that approach. And when I was at the, through the museum, and who knows how I got invited into Ron's home. He was deceased at the time, and got a chance to spend a couple of hours talking with his widow. But, you know, nonetheless, that's where I ended up, and that's what I did. And she told me the story of what occurred. And what Ron realized is that was Golgotha. That was the empty tomb. They were both part of the highest ground of Moriah, and he knew that that place was important. There was something important there, and I don't think he dug because he was looking for the Ark of the Covenant. I think perhaps he wanted to find Jeremiah's grotto. But I don't think he was specifically searching for the Ark of the Covenant. He just wanted to see what was there. There were some interesting passageways. And because he made the effort, he found the receptacle for the for Passover's pole, upright pole.
But you know, if you knew this, knew that the priest would always sprinkle the blood on the thing, you would think that would have been a great clue when you start thinking about what's below
it.
Well,
that's what happened next, because then he found the earthquake crack that the eyewitnesses talk about. And then he put two and two together. Wait a minute. Blood of the sacrificial lamb, earthquake crack, goes through that. Ark of the Covenant's got to be...
Ark of the Covenant has
got to be right below this. Put it all together. And so he managed to get below, and he went into a room that was filled kind of with some debris, and couldn't make much of it. Had to give up for that day. It was really tough sledding. The next day, went back down, and the room was completely clean, completely clear.
That's kind of
there's some of the temple, implements are there, but right in the middle of the room, there's the Ark of the Covenant. And there's a Moloch, who is a being of light, standing behind it. And the back wall glows jewel-like rainbow colors.
Amazing.
And asked the Moloch, what can I do here? Can I take this out? No. But you want to see the tablets? Oh, yeah. Well, here they are. Can I take the tablets out? No. No, you're not going to do that. Take a picture? Oh, sure. Take a picture.
Oh, yeah.
See what happens if you take a picture of a polar bear in a snowstorm, of light. Yeah, what you get is swirls of light. All right, so he took a picture of the Ark of the Covenant, the Moloch standing behind it, had a conversation with the Moloch, and first he noticed that there was blood on the right hand of the mercy seat, and he looked up, and there was the crack that he had found right beneath the post where the upright pole of Pesach had been. And that was Yosha's blood, the sacrificial lamb, right there. And then he talked to the Moloch, and he says, how long have you been here? Been here ever since the Ark was put here.
Yeah, 2 days.
Yeah, yeah, it's been a couple of days. Well, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
How long are you going to be here? And he says, until the Sunday law is established, and I'm going to, I've been instructed to hold up the tablets etched in stone. You can see right here on the second tablet is almost completely dominated by is the Shabbat, the Sabbath that you shall keep is set apart. I'm going to hold this up so that the whole world can see it simultaneously. The moment that the Sunday law is established, and that's my instructions. That's when I'm going to reveal this to the world. The whole world's going to see it. Now, can you imagine being Ron Wyatt? You've been a Christian. You think that God established Sunday. Sunday worship, Easter Sunday, and that the these tablets are going to be used to refute Sunday?
Sunday.
Oh, in fact, on his deathbed, he said it twice. He said, I know that I have said that it's going to be, that these tablets are going to be held up to refute the Antichrist's new calendar. But he says, I'm on my deathbed now. I want to clear that up. I want to make sure you understand. What he actually said is they're going to be held up to refute the Sunday laws. You know how difficult that would have been for a Ron Wyatt to say?
Well, his whole life thinking.
Yeah. Now,
no different than yours or mine, though.
Up to a point, because I read Ron Wyatt's last witness about what he saw there. And what it meant to him. And it's clear he'd put it together. He had come to know that the Torah was embodied by the Pesach lamb, and that it was fulfilled in perfect detail. And he wrote about it. So he came to put the pieces together at the end. Now, I don't know if he went all the way to then understanding the covenant, since he found the Ark of the Covenant. I hope so.
Yeah.
But the story of the Ark being there, the moment I heard it, I understood it to be true. I didn't understand it to be true because the testimony of Ron Wyatt, his testimony actually wasn't all that credible. What was credible is what the Malak said. What's credible is the location of it, because it's exactly where it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
And my response beyond, of course that story is true, because it is exactly consistent with everything Yahweh has said and done. And my second response was, would I ever love to be able to go there, not to see the Ark of the Covenant. You and I are going to see the Ark of the Covenant plenty.
Yeah.
I don't even, not to see the tablets etched with Yahweh's own finger to check out his penmanship. Not even to meet the Malak, and who knows, man, that guy really does need some company.
He's not suffering. 2 days is not a
problem. I know. I'm just being silly. I want to go there for an entirely different reason. And I've wanted to go there, because Yahweh made it really clear. It says, you do not take anything out. In fact, when Ron came out and told the story, one of his associates, kind of not really an associate, it's been Ron's whole story, life story, that everybody he's ever done anything with undermined him. The guy went in to become the Indiana Jones of archaeology and to remove the Ark of the Covenant. Well, he didn't last a week. Poof, gone, dead. So I realize you don't go in there if Yahweh was going to prevent you. If your purpose is to do something God doesn't want done, you can't go there. Now, Ron found it because he was rational, because he was devoted, because he was willing to go with the evidence led. Most religious people can't do that. He was willing to follow the trail of the words.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what brought him to the right place. I want to go there, and I've asked to go there, but it's one of those things, unless you were really hit over the head and said, okay, you can go there. I want to go there because I would like to be able to take digital photography of the original Torah scroll,
mm-hmm.
which is still sitting beside the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
It's the scroll there that I would like access to, and I would like to take digital pictures of it so we could translate it and read the original autograph.
Yeah, pure source.
Yeah, just a pure source. I would. Now,
how good is that?
Yeah, that would be really cool. Now, do we need it? No. The Dead Sea Scrolls do
fill in most of the gaps.
Not only fill in most of the gaps. There's so little difference between the Masoretic, with one so long as you realize that the Masoretic text actually has Yahweh's name in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they wrote Adonai over it, but the Yahweh's name is actually in it. And so long as you realize that the 22 letters that comprise the Hebrew language are correctly represented throughout the Masoretic text, particularly of the Torah, that the primary difference is their vocalization of words, which change, for example, an Adon to Edon.
Edon to Adon.
Edon, yes, vocalization. So long as you're willing to look at the letters themselves and look at what word using those letters is the most consistent with the conversation and the context, you can peel back most of the issues. And then the few places where they just went off on their own little tangent, the Dead Sea Scrolls do a marvelous job of pulling that back and affirming that what we read today is consistent with what Yahweh
shared.
Yeah. So the Dead Sea Scrolls are extremely valuable. The location of the Ark, I look at the same way. What it does is it's a piece of evidence from a non-Torah source that helps me better understand how Yahweh, as the sacrificial lamb, actually shed his blood right there on the mercy seat, for it to be there all of the symbolism that he went to great lengths to provide now is tangible.
Mm-hmm. It's not in woo-woo land. It's
right.
Absolutely where how it works.
Right. And the other thing is that once I came to understand how Paul is the plague of death, and that Christianity is a deadly religion, it makes perfect sense that the Torahless one, known to Christians as the Antichrist, is going to be possessed by the same demon that possessed Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to make exactly the same claims. And so when the Moloch said, yeah, I'm going to hold these tablets up, when the Sunday law is imposed, I already knew that the Torahless one is going to mimic Paul, and that God's enemy is the religion of Christianity. And so it made perfect sense. It's just another affirmation of what we knew to be true.
That's so staggering. I mean, not to me anymore, but
yeah.
It was just the realization that, I mean, we're not just confused. Christianity wasn't just confused. It's the enemy.
It's the enemy.
That's horrible to think.
Yeah. Yeah, the Torahless one is going to be embraced by Christians, largely because he's going to embrace Christianity.
Oh.
Yeah, and in fact, you even have in Barack Obama a lot of this. You know, a fellow who is a secular humanist, Princeton kind of education, a secular humanist institution, was born a Muslim, got Islamic education. His father was a Muslim, and then converted to Christianity, and so was a blend of those three.
Right.
Uses all three. Speaks very positively about all three.
Yes. No God he don't like.
Right. Yeah, because particularly since he's the living embodiment of his God. That's exactly what we're going to witness in the Torahless one. That's now that Barack Obama is not the Torahless one. The Torahless one is a political fellow right now in Macedonia. Probably now in his, right around 30 years old, could be in his early 30s. But that's his age, in all likelihood was educated in one of the premier Western universities, whether it's Yale, Princeton, Harvard, Stanford, or Cambridge, or Oxford.
Yep.
Most likely has a father that was a Muslim and a mother that was an Orthodox Christian. Same pedigree. And he's going to tout Pauline Christianity. Because that's the ultimate. I mean, who was the most Torahless one in human history? It wasn't Hadrian. It was Paul.
Paul.
Yeah, Paul.
Who's the most quoted man in the universe?
Paul.
Paul.
Yeah, Paul. The most infamous man. That's right. So the kinds of things that Ron Wyatt found particularly interesting is that very few people know of Ron Wyatt.
Mm-hmm.
And almost no one talks about his finding of the Ark of the Covenant.
Which
his own family won't talk about the finding of the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, because it's tied with the Torah, and
right.
You have to abandon
only,
the Torah.
There's only one group of people in the world. Because Ron's not given any credit for finding Noah's Ark. He is not given any credit for finding the Nuweiba Beach crossing. Not given any credit for founding Mount Horeb. None. Anywhere. By anyone. There's only one place that what he has found is discussed and benefited from. Our covenant family.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I don't think that Yahweh used Ron. I think Ron was a wonderful guy. I would have loved to have gotten to know Ron Wyatt. And I think I kind of do know him just by his videos and mm-hmm. his writings. But I view him like the Bedouin boy who stumbled upon the Dead Sea Scrolls, like the religious publications of the lexicons.
Mm-hmm.
They have value, even though I don't think God had anything to do with their publication or their discovery. what Ron found.
I grew up reading literally in high school, when I was very young, reading Emanuel Velikovsky, who was a Jewish guy who's brilliant, knew 20 ancient languages, and tried to say, okay, if the Torah says this, this, and this, it must be some proof out there that all these things happen. And he writes enormous things. And in the 40s and 50s, all his books were banned because they were too scientific. They were proving, every time they'd have a scientific discovery, it proved that he'd said, well, that's because it was already there. He'd written about him. So he was butchered.
You look at David Rohl, who I wrote that book called The Test of Time. David Rohl wasn't always right. For example, his explanations of the location of Eden are erroneous. Mm-hmm. But his explanations of where Goshen is and his timing of Egyptian history, of depicting the time of the Exodus, I find absolutely brilliant, as I find the Egyptian discussions with and affirmations of Abraham, as well as his finding the individuals, the boys that were murdered by the Egyptians, the actual buildings that were being built at Goshen. There is a lot that David Rohl writes that I think is absolutely brilliant, and he's the only person advocating it. And guess what? Just like Ron Wyatt, he has a whole world of foes that criticize everything he says.
Well, anything that even hints that the Torah may be correct will be attacked.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and so,
it's
so
not
he,
that they've embraced it. It's just they did research like any historian would or any archaeologist would, and they said, "Wow, look at this. What do we do with this information? If it's true, it changes your perspective, and you can't have that."
Correct. So that, you know, we've dedicated a whole program here to the things that Ron Wyatt found. What do they convey? What we can learn from them? And how Yahweh works in terms of letting us know. It never stands in the way of anyone coming to know him. And yet how even that knowledge doesn't have any value unless you can
transfer,
right? Unless it causes you to make the necessary connections to understand.
Right.
And then once you come to understand, then you're in a position to capitalize on what you have learned.
And well said.
Yeah, that's the beauty of each of these things, whether it's the Ark of Noah, the location of Sodom, the Nuweiba Beach crossing during the Exodus,
that's
the location of
cool.
Mount Horeb, the water gushing from the stone, the altar for the golden calf, or the Ark of the Covenant. All of these things, Yahweh told us those stories, and they are based in history, so that various people at various times would benefit from them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's aspects of the story that people wouldn't benefit from for a very long time. Like when Ron Wyatt told us that the back wall where the of limestone, where the Ark of the Covenant is like jewels, but glowing, radiating the colors of the rainbow.
You know, the Moloch are described a lot of time. When they talk about a Moloch, they'll list a range of colors that they appear in, which is, and obviously because they're light, now that we understand that they are light, then it makes perfect sense. And, you know, because I'd kept looking up, well, what kind of rock is this, and da-da-da, and after a while, you go, oh, duh.
Yeah. You know what I also think is fascinating?
It's a rainbow. It's light breaking down through a prism.
Is that Ron Wyatt started with the Ark of Noah and ended up with the Ark of the Covenant.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool because those things are absolutely related.